Welcome to Halacha in a Year, where we can get to learn all the most relevant halacha through the prism of the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. You are listening to Rabbi Yaakov Tramp. This shiur is kindly sponsored by the Moshe Group and CA in Zuchus of Rivka Bela Bas Nechama Shifra and in honor of Rabbi Tramp.
We are going to continue our learning the halachas of Ribbis of Interest. This is Simon Samachet, the 65th chapter in the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. We looked at a number of concepts about classic ribbis, early and late ribbis, favors, exchanges and collateral, extending credit and selling debt in the last section of ribbis. Today we're going to be focusing on four basic concepts, and they are advancing funds for later purchases, buying and selling in different markets, upfront rentals and commitments, and finally, ribbis between Jews and non-Jews. This is an exceptionally complicated area in halacha. And unfortunately, most people do not spend time enough actually learning it to be aware of where the pitfalls exist. So when we learn through the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch, this is not a comprehensive of every single case, but it's an awareness to be aware of where questions should be asked when dealing with this. This comes down to all kinds of money interactions and transactions. We're going to look at our first concept, which is advancing funds for later purchases. Let's jump straight in. Question number one, can I pay for a piece of merchandise now, which you'll later procure and give to me? So the answer is no. The reason is because the concern is, let's say I pay you $1,000 for merchandise X, you don't have it. You're going to procure it in, let's say, a month's time when it comes into your inventory, but it may increase in a price. So it might be I'm getting a $1,100 piece of merchandise, which means that because of the time, I'm getting more money. That is called ribbis. That's a problem. What happens if you already have the merchandise in inventory, you're just delivering it, so you have it in the storehouse, you have it there around, you don't have to procure it, then there's no problem. Because it's considered like I bought an item, an expensive item at a good price, right? Obviously the seller cannot stipulate the price right now is because of it being paid up front, otherwise you're paying for the time. What happens if you have the product, which I'm paying for now, but it isn't ripe? Or needs processing. So you have it in your storehouse, I'm paying for it now, you're going to give it to me later, but it needs a little bit of time to be ready for consumption or use. That's allowed as long as it doesn't need more than three steps of processing in order to get there. What happens if I could have bought the merchandise at the time of sale for the same price on the open market? So I am buying from you $1,000 worth of apples, and it would be giving a certain amount of poundage. And even though you don't have it, but on the market, I could get $1,000 worth of apples for the same amount of pounds at the same time. In that case, I do not have to be concerned about the concern of ribbis like we were concerned before, because I could have bought it from someone else, and then the appreciation value of the apples, even though the apples went up from 1,000 to 1,100 for that amount of weight, I am really, that would have been something which would happen in my own property if I bought it from somebody else right now. I'm buying it from you. But it's as if the appreciation happened in my domain. So there's two ways of buying, advancing money for merchandise. Either the seller has it in an inventory, or number two is that it's available on open market at the same price at the time of sale. What happens if I fronted the money in heter? So either the seller had an inventory, or it was available on open market, and then the price goes up. Can you give me the other merchandise at the same price? So let's say I buy $1,000 worth of apples from you. You already have $1,000 of apples. You just need to deliver it to me by a certain amount of pounds. And the agreement is that you're going to deliver it in a week. In a week's time, apples have gone up to $1,100 for the same amount of pounds. We said that's allowed because the merchandise existed in the inventory at the beginning. So let's say the seller now says, I'll give you $1,100 worth of oranges instead. That's allowed. And you can even give back the buyer $1,100 itself. That's fine because it's not considered ribbis in this case. That's considered an investment which is appreciated. What about paying me back money for the higher price? And that we just said is that's fine as well. Let's move into the next concept, buying and selling in different markets. So what happens if you have merchandise worth $4,000 locally? On the local market, but I know it's worth $5,000 in a different locale. The demand is higher there. So I say to you, look, I'll take your merchandise. I'll sell it off in the more expensive locale, and I'll come back and I'll give you the $5,000 minus the amount of expenses and effort it took me to be your agent to this. So this is all right, but it depends. It depends on whose responsibility it is on the merchandise. So let's say I'm taking your merchandise. I'm going into the city to sell it at a higher price, and then something happens. It falls off the cart, falls into a ditch, and is broken. Who bears responsibility? If the buyer, that means the agent, is a responsible party, it is Asr. If the seller, that's the owner of it originally, is responsible, then it would be Mutar. Why? What's the difference? So if the buyer, that's the agent, has the responsibility, then it's like basically the sale took place immediately. So you gave me $5,000, you gave me a $4,000 item. I essentially bought it for you from you right then, because I now have a responsibility for it. And when the goods were given, but then at the time of the payment, I'm paying you more money. Why? Because I essentially took a loan, right? I am paying you more money for the amount of time it took to get you the item. But if the seller has responsibility, that means the sale has not taken place till the time that the money's been gotten. So the owner gives $4,000 worth of merchandise. The responsibility remains his. Then the sale takes place for $5,000. Now I'm returning the $5,000 minus the effort. That's fine, because now essentially that was when the sale happened. It was at the time that the actual transaction happened. How do you know that? Because the responsibility for the object along the way was that of not the agent, but the seller. Therefore, it's not a loan, which is being paid back more for. What happens if I lend you $100 to go to a sale and buy something, provided that when you get back, you give me $120, right? So I'm fronting you the money. You're going to take the money, but you're going to pay me back more when you get back. And it's worth it for you because you don't have the cash. So you're going to pay that extra. It's worth doing this for you, and it's worth doing it for me because it's an investment. So it depends again. If the lender takes responsibility for the money in transit and the lender brings the item home, right? So I am the one who's saying, I'll give you $100. I'm lending you the money. And when you bring the item back, I'm going to put it in my house. Right, then it's considered as if it's a purchase and an appreciation of the purchase, so I can get back $120 from you then. It would be all right in that situation. If it were the other way around, and you bore responsibility, the person who is going, the borrower takes responsibility, then it's considered not a transaction, it's considered a loan, and therefore you're getting more money back on your loan. That is ribis. If, that's the fourth question. If I know you're going to a place where the merchandise is cheap, can I ask you to buy merchandise for me there, and I'll pay you back a little more for the effort involved? So again, it is allowed as long as the agent is responsible for the money in transit. That's because because there's no loan. The money remains the sender's, and then is invested in an object, and the sender pays a higher value because of the appreciation or the effort involved at the higher rate. So again, we're trying to define, is this a purchase or is this a loan? And that depends on who bears responsibility for either the asset or the money in transit before it gets to the point of purchase. That is the critical discussion in all of these questions. We're looking next at our next concept. Our next concept is upfront rentals and commitments. We're going to be looking at four basic questions. If I'm renting out real estate, can I make a deal that if I'm paid up front for the year, I'll accept $10,000, but if you pay me back, if you rent it for by the month, it'll be $1,000 a month, amounting to $12,000. The answer is yes. Why is this allowed? Isn't this considered charging more for the time? The answer is no, because technically speaking, rent is the responsibility to be paid at the end of the rental period. And therefore, really the fixed price of this is $12,000, because it's $1,000 a month. When I offer you the option of paying me $10,000 up front, that is a reduction because of getting the money early. It's not that I'm charging you more. It's not that the base is $10,000 and I am now charging you extra because of the time for $12,000 for the year. No. $12,000 is the base. $10,000 is a reduction because of getting the cash up front and not having to chase after you. If I am employing somebody, can I do the same thing? So to pay less upfront to pay more later on. So it depends. If the worker has not started working and I say, I'm going to pay your wages ahead of time and it's going to be a reduction, that's a problem. Because then you're essentially giving him that's a loan for which you're getting not just back the value of the money, but also extra because of the time. But if he's already started working, then it's like real estate rental. It's already started, and therefore it's not considered a loan. It's considered repaying the wages, and you can pay a reduction of wages earlier. If somebody is marrying off a daughter and commits to giving the couple a certain amount of money for that wedding, can they increase that money that they committed to give? The answer, it should be obvious, but they are certainly allowed to do that. Because it's like saying to another person, I'll give you a gift by next week, and if I don't, I'll give you more. So I'm sort of like, you know, locking myself into this commitment. But it has to be explicated, it has to be articulated at the time of the tanaim, at the time of when the condition is made, and should not be added on later on, because otherwise it looks like you're paying extra because of the time. Okay, final and last concept, and that is our concept of ribbis and non-Jews we're going to deal with in this section 9 questions. As we know, the Torah tells us that Jews cannot charge Jews interest, but they may charge and they should charge non-Jews interest, and they can borrow with interest from non-Jews as well. And this is not because it's punishing the non-Jews. That's the default in regular commodities, is interest is paid. People pay for money, time is worth money, and so therefore you rent your money, and it's something which is worth paying for. However, when it comes to Jews, the Torah gives a remittance. So let's go into some of the halachos. What happens if a Jew borrowed money from a non-Jew with ribbis, but another Jew is the guarantor, right? So one Jew is borrowing money from a non-Jew with interest, that's fine. But another Jew is the guarantor, is that a problem? So it depends. If the guarantor can only be claimed from if the borrower defaults, then it's fine. Because really, the loan was a Jew from a non-Jew with ribbis, that's fine. And then the guarantor, if he has to be claimed against, that's the non-Jew's business against him. However, if the guarantor would come first, meaning so there's some types of loans that are set up, the guarantor can be claimed from first, that's a problem, because it's like a guarantor was the one who borrowed money from the non-Jew, and he, the guarantor, lended the money to a Jew. So it's essentially the ribbis that's being charged is essentially from the guarantor to the borrower, which is a Jew to Jew. What happens in the other case? What happens if a non-Jew borrows money from a Jew with interest? That's fine. But then the non-Jew has a Jewish guarantor. So same thing. If the guarantor can only be claimed from if the borrower defaults, then it's fine. Because in this case, what's going to happen is the lender, which is a Jew, will come to the non-Jew, who's the borrower. If he defaults, then he'll go to the Jew. But that it wasn't as if there was a loan Jew to Jew. But if the guarantor can be claimed from first, then it's like the loan is Jew to Jew, and that's a real problem. What happens if a non-Jew wants to borrow from a Jew with interest, but he sends a Jew to be the agent to give the collateral and bring him back the money? That's not a problem, because the Jew has no responsibility as the agent in the middle. The only thing is, he cannot have any responsibility for the money or the collateral in the process of transition. What about the reverse? A Jew wants to borrow money from a non-Jew with interest, and he sends a Jew as the agent to bring the collateral. Again, this is allowed because the Jew is dead, bears no responsibility in the middle for this as well. What happens if a Jew lends to a Jew without interest on a collateral, and then when the loan matures, the borrower tells the lender to borrow money from a non-Jew based on that collateral? So again, a Jew is lending money to a Jew without interest. Good, that's all good. There's a collateral. When the loan matures, the borrower says to the lender, you go and use my collateral to borrow more money from a non-Jew with interest, so you're getting more than you would have got from me. If the lender agrees to those terms, that's fine, because that's not considered as if it's a Jew from a Jew with interest. It's considered a separate loan, even though it's the same collateral. What happens if a Jew lends money to a non-Jew with interest on a collateral? That's fine. And at some point during the term, he asks for a loan for the same amount from a fellow Jew. So the lender's now asking for the same amount from a fellow Jew, and he says, on that collateral, and he says to this other Jew who now becomes his lender, you know, when you collect from me, collect from the non-Jew with the interest. In this case, it's fine because it's considered like he's selling the debt. That's totally fine. The only problem is that if the first Jew converted the loan to the non-Jew, that both the interest and the capital are the same loan, so he converts them into one loan, that's a problem. Because now, when the new lender, the Jew, is going to come to the non-Jew to collect both the capital and the interest, really the interest is belonging to the middleman Jew, and therefore it's considered like he's collecting interest from a Jew. What if a Jew invests money with a non-Jew to get back interest? So very common. So a Jew comes to a non-Jew and says, look, I'll give you $5,000 and at a fixed interest rate. And then the non-Jew takes her money, and this is how it works, will lend it to somebody else. But what happens with somebody else is lending it to is a Jew with interest? So is it considered like the Jew is lending to another Jew with interest with a non-Jewish middleman? The answer is no. That's how this works. It's a Jew lending to a non-Jew for interest, and a non-Jew lending to a Jew for interest. That's how everybody makes money. It is fine as well. The Kitzer points out that you have to be careful about agencies, let's say investment funds, which are owned by Jews, that haven't done a heter iska. We'll discuss that next time, and which allows certain forms of interest collection. Even if they employ non-Jewish employees, because they own it, they're the middleman, and that's a real issue. What if two Jews are in partnership and they borrow money from a non-Jew? How do they pay the interest? So one has to be careful that one is not paying for the other. So it's not one paying for the other, because then one person's paying essentially the other person's interest. And it needs to be, a shaila needs to be asked how to arrange this best. And finally, can I charge or pay interest to an apostate Jew? Jews left Torah mitzvos, so that Kitzer paskins that one may not borrow from him with interest, and one should be machmir not to even lend to him with interest as well, which is fascinating. Which means to say is that in this particular case, we don't view him like a non-Jew. We do view him like a Jew, not to charge him interest. With this, we conclude the very fascinating and complex halachas that relate to ribbis. We're going to discuss next time the notion of a heter iska and how these businesses navigate these issues. Have a wonderful meeting.